to Shattering Myths, where we expose the misconceptions associated with religion and politics, military and economic schemes. Our number, should you wish to question or challenge anything that you are hearing today, is 877-300-7645. This is my favorite part of the program. This is the part of the program where we're going to engage God on His terms. We're going to come to know Him as He revealed Himself. If you are an atheist or an agnostic and saying, oh my goodness, why has a religious program taken over my station? Fear not. This discussion will be anti-religious. It will not be religious at all. In fact, throughout this discussion, we're going to impugn all religion. You see, God is not religious. He hates religion. It isn't a case that all religions lead to Him. It's the case that all religions lead away from Him. So this discussion through His Torah, which, by the way, does not mean law, but means being, will focus on what He actually said. Now, in our review of this material yesterday, the point was made that Yahweh uses prophecy to prove His existence. He is not interested in faith. He is not interested in belief. He is interested, as the scientist is, in evidence and reason. And that is why if you are an agnostic, if you are an atheist, and you have rejected God because you have been told that to accept God, you have to abandon evidence and reason, and that you have to instead move into the realm of faith and belief, or that you have rejected God because of some of the stupid claims associated with religion, good news. God has nothing to do with those stupid claims, and His entire message to us is designed to present evidence which leads to a rational conclusion. And the way that He proves His existence is through prophecy, by recording specific, I can't even use the word predictions, because God is not predicting the future. He is reporting future events in our past, because He has already seen them. And for those who are agnostics and atheists who understand the nature of light and they understand the dimension of time, they know how that is possible, that He uses this to prove His existence. And then He speaks to us through His Torah. Now, while we're going to focus on Yah's, and that is short for Yahweh's protective testimony, do not assume that prophecy will completely monopolize our time. I say that because every prediction, Yahweh teaches us something important, something often profound. And since these instructions are coming from God, the guidance He is providing along with them is vastly more important than the fact He reliably foretells our future. That might fascinate us, and we will delve into such fascinations, because I can tell you exactly when the major events in future history are going to transpire and who is going to be behind them. And while that will be interesting, you should be far more interested in what Yah provides in terms of guidance so that you can avoid those calamities and become part of His family. So not only does God prove His existence and His authorship of His Torah, prophets, and Psalms, everything He has to say is designed to direct us to His covenant. In no uncertain terms, Yahweh will tell us who He is, what He wants, and what He is willing to offer us in return for our affection. You know, when in the first part of the program we talked about George Zimmerman saying, I think this was God's will. Well, if you want to know Yahweh's will, read the Torah. And what you will find there is that the only thing that is important to Him is the covenant, nothing else. And the covenant is available to all of us. There's only one of them. It has not yet been renewed. And it is available to Yehudim and Goyim, Jew and Gentile alike. And in the end, all Yah is going to salvage of this entire universe, of all of the life and all of the stars and all of the planets, is His covenant family. All the rest of it will cease to exist. Everything, the entire universe and life itself, was conceived for a singular purpose, and that is because God wants to have a family-oriented relationship with individuals who have been part of His creation. Now, these things known, Do not assume that this discussion will be religious. It will not be. The God of the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, errantly known as the Old Testament, is anti-religious. That term, Old Testament, is completely bogus. It was conceived by an anti-Semitic individual named Marcion, who was the principal promoter of Paul. Marcion didn't like Jews. He didn't like the God of Abraham, Yitzhak, and Jacob. He didn't like the message of the Torah. He was a Gnostic. He liked Paul because Paul was opposed to the God of Abraham, Yitzhak, and Jacob. Because Paul was opposed to the Torah, Marcion fell in love with Paul and became his primary ambassador. And so to create the illusion that the testimony of the old God was now a God that no longer mattered, it was old, it was the testimony of a now deceased deity, and that we had a new message and a new God, what is the Torah, prophets, and Psalms was renamed the Old Testament, and this new God and this new message, which was entirely different and unrelated to that old message, was called the New Testament. This may come as a shock to Christians, but the covenant has not been renewed. There can be no New Testament. In fact, there will never be a New Testament, and the covenant itself has not yet been renewed. The place where its renewal is discussed is the book of Yirmiyahu in the 31st chapter. And Christians are wont to quote one verse of that out of context, mistranslated, to create the impression that they are now living in the age that was ushered in by their Jesus Christ to create a New Testament. But the Messiah Yahusha, which is his actual name, said the opposite. He said that not one jot and tittle, no, not even a part of a letter of the Hebrew letters that comprise the Hebrew words of the Torah and prophets will be annulled. Not one aspect of one letter of one word will be annulled. Every question he answered by citing the Torah and the prophets. And yet Christians are of this myth that he brought in a new religion. He hated religion. He spoke vehemently against religion. Now in the Yirmiyahu prophecy that speaks of a renewing and a restoration of the covenant, if you read that, and we will cover it in detail as part of this program, the first thing you learn is that the renewal and restoration is not with Goyim, and therefore not with the Christian church. It is with Yehuda and with Yisrael. Yehuda means related to Yah, and Yisrael means individuals who engage, who endure, who are empowered by Yah. And so it isn't even with Gentiles. The next thing that you read after the fact that this newly revised, newly restored, newly affirmed from Kadosh variation, if you will, of the covenant, only differs from the existing covenant in one aspect. Only one difference between the covenant as it was established with Abraham and the renewal of the covenant when it is finally renewed. One difference. And that difference is that Yah's Torah teaching will be written inside of us when the covenant is renewed. Now that's something he cannot do now. Now we are under free will. We all have the option to accept, reject, ignore, or convolute Yah's Torah teaching as well as his covenant. And we can do that because it is not ingrained in us. We have to seek it out. We have to choose to observe it. We have to choose to consider it for us to participate in it. That's the whole purpose of free will. But a time was going to come when everyone will have made their choice. When Yahusha returns and people have either chosen to accept or to reject the terms and conditions of the covenant, at that time, those who have chosen to reject it will cease to exist. Those who have chosen to accept it as opposed to reject it will now be part of Yah's family, adopted into his home. And so at that time, since we have made our choice, we can benefit by having Yah's teaching literally integrated into our very nature. And that's what he says. That has not happened yet, which means that the covenant has not yet been renewed. And as a death nail to the religion of Christianity, when it is finally renewed, it will be renewed on the basis of the wholesale integration of the Torah. Now, it's an interesting insight here for those who are more interested in a really deep analysis of what this means. But it ties into Yahusha's Sermon on the Mount, where he talked about the fact that not a jot or a tittle, not a single aspect of the Torah, not a single letter of a single word would be annulled until the heaven and the earth no longer exists. The reason for that statement and the reason for this timing is because Torah can exist both as a capital T and speak of the five books that were scribed by Moshe, and as a lowercase t and speak of Yahweh's source of teaching, guidance, and direction. As a lowercase t, Yah's teaching, his guidance, his direction is going to be essential for us as we enjoy eternity, so that we can continue to have free will, but not goof something up, because we're going to have enormous power in eternity. We'll be very much like light and extraordinarily more energetic and probably able to maneuver in seven dimensions and understand the universe from a seven-dimensional perspective. So his guidance, his teaching will be ongoing. The existing Torah will no longer be meritorious. It won't have value because the purpose of the existing Torah is to teach us, to guide us from our human institutions, from the corruption of religion and politics, to Yahweh's covenant family. That's what it exists to do. But in eternity, we will all be members of Yah's covenant family, and therefore that aspect of God's teaching will have no longer have the ongoing merit, and we will need his guidance so that we know how to live our lives throughout eternity. Well, that's the end of this segment of Shattering Myths. We'll continue this discussion on the other side of the break. 877-300-7645. Shattering Myths, where we expose the misconceptions associated with religion and politics, with military and economic schemes. In this last segment, I was explaining why God was opposed to religion. We've had a caller. His name is Steve. He is calling from Seattle, and he has a question regarding how it could be that that God is anti-religious. Hello, Steve. Are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Hi. Go ahead and ask your question, Steve.
Well, you say that God's against religion, but in the Old Testament, there's a temple and the priesthood and all the goings on in the temple. Is that not religion?
Okay. It's a great question. Let me answer your question. In the, first of all, there is no Old Testament, but I understand that it's tough to disassociate with terms the first time you might hear that they are incorrect. There's the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, no Old Testament. He has one temple. His singular temple is typically based on one of two words which tell us what it represents. It's either based on the Hebrew word beyeth, which means house and home, which identifies it with his Bereth covenant, or he speaks about it using words that are derivatives of Kodesh. Kodesh is the Hebrew word for set apart. The whole concept God has is he wants his family to be set apart from human institutions, whether those human institutions be religious or political ones. He wants his people to walk away from them so that they can walk to him and enter his family and his home. So his the one building that was either the portable tabernacle during the time of the Exodus, which is a shelter, the tabernacle is all about, and related directly to the seventh of the festival feast. It's called Sukkah, which means shelters. It's often referred to as tabernacles. The goal of the path that God has created to him ends up with us entering his home and becoming part of his family. And so if we come to view God as being the father of a family, and our goal is to enter his home, which is what was represented by the temple, then we will understand the picture that God is painting by way of this covenant relationship. Now, that's the first half of it. The second half of your question dealt with the priests. Kohen is the Hebrew term. It means those who intercede, those who act as intermediaries. The priests were one of the 12 tribes. We misquote them or misquote God and call them the Levites. There's no V in Hebrew, so they could not be Levites. They were the Lowi. The Lowi's job, their name, means those who intercede and those who unite. And they were specifically given two responsibilities, and only two responsibilities, and neither of those responsibilities was religious. The first responsibility they were given was to intercede on behalf of the people, to help the people understand the symbolism of each of Yah's seven steps. There are seven steps that we walk from our world to his. They are Passover, unleavened bread, first fruits, seven Sabbaths, trumpets, reconciliations, and shelters. Shelters is the destination, which is God's home. So during each of these, they are rife with symbolism. They're rife with metaphor. They're filled with all sorts of things that help us understand specifically how God has enabled us to leave our polluted world and enter his perfect realm. They speak of Passover as all about eternal life. Unleavened bread is our redemption, making us appear perfect so we can enter God's presence. First fruits is about us being born anew and being adopted into Yahweh's family. Seven Sabbaths is about being enriched with the Torah and being empowered by the Spirit so that our relationship with God can grow and so that we can become effective witnesses. That's the message of these festival feasts. And so the Lowi were specifically tasked with helping the people understand those so they could observe those in a way that was meaningful to them, that would guide them into the covenant family of Yahweh. The second job that the Lowi were given was to act as judges to judge disputes. And the purpose of that was they were specifically confined to the Torah. That the Torah would be the constitution, if you will, for the children of Yisrael. And so they were, if the people had a dispute, the Lowi were given the responsibility of trying to resolve those disputes in a manner that was consistent with Yah's Torah guidance. So there isn't a speck of religion in any of that. That's the end of this segment. Thank you, Steve, for asking that question, and we'll be back right after the break. 877-300-7645. This is Shattering Myths. Hello, and welcome back to Shattering Myths, where we expose the misconceptions associated with religion and politics, military and economic schemes. We have another caller whose name is Jason. Jason is in Toronto. Jason, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Yada. I've been really enjoying the show. Also, the Blog Talk Radio, I enjoyed that for quite some time at work. Just plugging in with my smartphone and listening to the commentary has been really enlightening. I appreciate what you're doing.
Thank you, Jason.
I was wondering, because although I enjoy the commentary and your insights, I really want to have the the personal experience that you're having with scriptures.
Mm-hmm.
And although I'm limited in that, I have two young children, full-time job, which is why I benefit so much from a program like yours. And, but I'm wondering, like, I have looked into, you know, sort of a resources that sort of teach me,
mm-hmm.
The God's tongue. Like,
yes.
I'm not so much interested in, the vowel points and stuff anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I really want to bypass all the interpretation and learn, God's language. And,
mm-hmm.
and so, what are the
sure?
What are the rules of the language? How do I get
okay.
to that and sort of bypass interpretation?
Okay, great question, and let me take a moment to answer your question. First, for those that don't know, I am using the name Yada. It means to know in Hebrew. As the host of this program, I'm trying to do so because of the fact that two reasons. One is I want to dissuade people from using that homonym argument. Which means to attack the messenger as opposed to the message. I'm happy for you to criticize the message, and we can talk about that. But I use the name Yada, which means to know. One of the reasons I also do that is I have a $100 million price on my head from Muslims for having written Prophet of Doom. And so using a name like Yada is helpful in keeping me alive, which my wife and children would prefer. The second thing that he mentioned is Blog Talk Radio. For 4 years, and their archives are available, and I would encourage those of you who are interested in my review of my most recent book, which is called An Introduction to God. You can listen to those archives there and come to know Yahweh as he introduced himself to us. Now, the difference between this program and the Introduction to God program that I did there is that the purpose of that program was to equip you as listeners to be able to study Yah's testimony on your own, to no longer have any need for me to serve as a guide at all, because my only role in this whole process is to help to serve as a guide to equip you so that you can do this on your own, because I don't want you to trust me. I don't want you to trust anybody. I want you to rely on Yah. And so Jason's question is particularly germane. The goal of this program is to inspire you, to encourage you to walk away from your religion, to open your mind, to use evidence and reason to come to know the creator of the universe, whose name is Yahweh, and to come to understand the covenant relationship he is offering and how we engage in it. And then once you have embraced that, to grow with him. And the way that you grow is you study his testimony, and you do it on your own. And so what Jason was saying is, how do I equip myself so I can go off and do this on my own and grow? And the reason that's so important, and I think Jason senses this, is that once you're a member of Yah's family, your entire eternity now is based on growing. And we grow through learning. And so all of eternity is going to be this wonderful ride through the universe with Yahweh himself as our guide, as our teacher, where we get to explore and learn and grow as a result of these experiences. But we can begin that process now. And the way that you do it is you come to observe. The Hebrew word is shamar, Yah's eduth, his testimony, especially his Torah. The two tools that I have found that are the most helpful are, first, interlinears. There's a number of interlinears that are free online, which you can, and you can also buy hardback interlinears. But an interlinear which juxtaposes the Hebrew and the English. The language of Revelation is Hebrew. When we translate it from Hebrew to English, we lose a lot. And I'll speak to that in just a second. But beyond that, if you want to know God, you almost have to begin to think in Hebrew, because Hebrew is so different than any other language. Now, that doesn't mean you need to learn how to speak it. That doesn't mean you need how to learn how to read it from sight. But it does mean that you have to deploy the tools that enable you to study his revelation in Hebrew. An interlinear is a first step to doing that. A second step is to acquire a number of lexicons. Now, again, you don't have to spend any money. There are a number of free lexicons available online. The best single tool that I'm aware of is called Logos Software. The original language version is a little under $400 these days, and it will give you a plethora of tools that will enable you to do this. Now, if I may, Jason, take another moment to explain the uniqueness of Hebrew as to why your question is, how do I come to understand and therefore learn and grow through an appreciation of Hebrew? Let me explain why Hebrew is so unique and why it is important to understand the testimony in Hebrew. In Hebrew, unlike English, there is no past, present, and future tense. None. All Hebrew verbs are eternally true in time. And that explains not only Yahweh's nature, whose name is based on the Hebrew verb, I exist, which means that he was, he is, and he always will be. That is what we are going to become. And so the only language that God can effectively and accurately reveal himself in, at least for you to understand the full nature of who he is in Hebrew, because Hebrew verbs are not stuck in time. They're always true. That which is said in Hebrew was true, is true, and will always be true. The second is that Hebrew has unique stems that are all relational stems that teach us about the relationship between the verb's action and the subject and the object of the verb. And powerful insights that you can garner that way. There are two conjugations in Hebrew. I shared one in our program yesterday, which is the imperfect as applied to the instruction that would be simplistically translated, you shall not kill. But when you apply the imperfect and understand that it speaks of habitual, ongoing behavior, it says, actually, you should not make a practice of killing. You should not kill on an ongoing basis. And so you learn from the stems that are unique, the conjugations that are unique to Hebrew. Lastly, Hebrew verbs are very often, and most verbs, are ascribed with a mood. Moods in Hebrew are almost all volitional. They explain that the statement that is being made is either Yahweh's will, or it is something that under the auspices of free will, he is sharing with us because he wants us to embrace, he wants us to choose what he's saying. Now, that is all very rich as part of the Hebrew language that is difficult to convey in English without, you know, going into great depth. Also, the depth of meaning associated with Hebrew words is far richer than it is in English. The Hebrew word kodesh, which we errantly translate holy, it means set apart. And we will do future programs on just that word, what it means to be set apart. And when you come to understand the power of Kodesh and what it means to be set apart relative to our world, religion and politics, for example, and being set apart to Yah in the spiritual realm, that word, which is just so ingrained in the Hebrew vocabulary, will teach you and lead you to a place that God would like you to be. So, did I answer your question, Jason?
Yeah, no, that was great. I'll have to. I'm looking forward to getting the Logos. I got to. It's on my wish list anyway. For now, I had one other quick question because I just started in Genesis with an interlinear, and actually it's kind of handy because it's on my mobile and I can point to a Hebrew word, and then it gives me a bunch of roots.
Oh, perfect.
It doesn't give me, like, prefix, suffix. It doesn't really help me as far as, you know,
moods, conjugations.
But I was looking at Genesis, and it seems like I was a little confused that chapter 1, it speaks of man being created on the sixth day. And then the second chapter, it seems to say from the English that before there was any vegetation, that he created man, and then he created all the beasts and had him name them and whatnot. So I was kind of wondering what the sort of chronology of that is, or
all right,
what
I'm
missing.
Yeah, let me go ahead and address some of that. First, we're going to devote a whole series of shows in this review, very early on in the process, after we get through this introduction of yada yada to the creation account. So we're going to begin with the Bereshith, which is the Hebrew word for in the beginning. And we're going to go through the chronology of creation, and I'm going to explain how 15 billion years of us looking back is exactly 6 24-hour days from the perspective of the Creator at creation, and how those are exactly the same amount of time. And we're going to explore that. And then we're going to explore what happened on each day and what those days represent. One of the big concerns about a lot of people who are atheists and say the creation account is bogus is that they interpret God is saying that he created the sun on the fourth day, but vegetation on the third day. And, of course, that would be impossible, and that isn't the order that things occurred. But that's not what he said at all. What he said is on the fourth day, the greater and the lesser lights shall be used as signs to help you understand the meeting times. And so the sun and the moon became visible to us on the fourth day, and then we'll get into great detail about how that it tells us precisely when the Messiah Yahusha would come into our world in the fourth generation, the fourth millennia of human history, and what that all represents. So it's going to be a very deep and fascinating discussion. There are two...
I didn't mean to interrupt, but...
Okay, I was going to ask you your last question, but go ahead, Will.
I know. Thank you.
Ask a new one.
I can... I'll be looking forward to you going through Genesis for sure. I'll be listening. But also when I was going through there, when it talks about the sun, moon, and stars being for signs and seasons, mm-hmm. days and years.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, like maybe I'm just trying to read too much into it or whatever, but do you think there is a way to read the stars to come to a conclusion?
Hello, and welcome back to Shattering Myths. Our telephone number is 877-376-45, and we're about the process of shattering the misconceptions associated with religion and politics. Before we went to the last break, Jason revised his three-part question to ask a new question, which is certainly fine because it happens to be a question with an interesting answer. He said, can you look to the stars and come to know something about Yahweh and his timing? And the answer is actually surprising, and the answer is yes. And it happens to coincide with one of the worst translations found anywhere in your current Bible. When Yahweh had offered his covenant relationship to Abram, and he was speaking of empowering Abram and enriching Abram and adopting Abram into his family, and causing Abram to be eternal in terms of his life and be perfected by this relationship, and all of the wonderful descendants that would fill Yah's covenant family as a result of this relationship that he and Abram were forming together. Abram, like so many of us, got caught in the mundane and tripped over his own feet. And he said, hey, come on, God, you know, what in the world do you offer me? I don't even have a kid. So God said, okay, we need to have a chat. He took Abram to a place that was set apart. And set apart is the whole concept of God is taking us to a place that is set apart from the world and set apart to him. Then he said, Abram, I want you to look up into the sky. I want you to look at the Shamayim, my spiritual home. I want you to look at my home as we're talking about this covenant, and now I want you to look at the light coming from those stars. Because if you come to understand my spiritual home and the nature of the light coming from those stars, that it is eternal, that it is powerful, that it is enlightening, that it is empowering, and that it is perfecting, it eliminates darkness. If you come to understand the light that is emanating from those stars, and you come to equate that with my Shamayim, a spiritual abode in heaven, then you will know precisely what I'm offering you through the covenant. That was Yahweh's answer to Abram. And so, yes, you can look to the stars and you can look to heaven and you can put the pieces together. Because the next thing Abram said is that he chose, as a result of coming to this understanding, to trust and rely upon Yahweh. And it is in light, which is the one thing that Yah equates his nature to, that we come to understand what we are going to become and what the benefits of the covenant are. Light enlightens. It perfects. And on light, we become eternal. Like light, time simply exists. The past, present, and the future exist simultaneously. And light is a beautiful substance in the sense that it has both an energy and a particle nature, which means that when we wish to accept a physical form in eternity, we'll be able to do so. And there's times we may want to do it, which is we can sing songs, we can eat meals, we can put our feet in a stream in a faraway planet. We can enjoy the warmth of a fire. But we'll be stuck in time while we take on physical form. But for the most part, we'll be energy just like light, just like Yahweh. When you come to understand why he equates himself with light that is emerging from those stars, and the fact that it is eternal, that it is enlightening, that it is powerful, that it is perfecting, then you come to understand precisely what he is offering us through the covenant. So that's my best answer, Jason, to your question. You also asked a question about what tools you can buy. I have been told that the Logo software, which is the software I was recommending, I don't make anything on this, I'm just telling you it's a very effective tool, is $415 currently on their site. There are those who I'm told have bought it for up to $100 less for as little as $315, and that they have very low interest payment plans should you want to finance that purchase over a period of time. So, Jason, that is the opportunity that exists there. You mentioned one other thing, and it was the third part of your last question, but unfortunately we're out of time on today's show, so I will address that question tomorrow. I want to thank you all for listening to Shattering Myths. I want to especially thank the callers to today's program. I look forward to being with you at this time again tomorrow. May Yah bless you all.
Pharmacist Ben Fuchs has learned the importance of good fats for good health. Good fats.